already in episode 78. It was after I published last week's episode that I realized we are right at the point, in fact, the day, 17 years ago, that I retired from the Air Force, and coming up on the date that I officially retired from civil service. And so what a coincidence that that is where we are in the journey. During this podcast has let me retrace that whole journey and my life, and it brings about some of those milestones that make you go, I can barely remember what it was like to go to work on a regular basis. And I remember when I hung up the uniform, the first time it was a little challenging, but the second time it was kind of easy, to be fair. As I go through the period from about 1995 to the present, there are a number of aspects that fit into the journey, but don't fit well into any single episode. And so these happen across decades sometimes of my life. And one of those is how and why I've been focused on philanthropy. I want to share with you a story, since it is about this time that I began to become more involved. Since graduating from William & Mary, I realized two important things. First, most of my education was paid for by the Air Force through a variety of programs for each of my degrees. And the most important realization is that the gift of education is one that deserves to be paid forward. In some ways, it's a little bit, and probably only a little, tied to the viewpoint that the press is talking about student debt forgiveness, because doing that means the taxpayers have to pick up that debt. It's not really just wiped off the books. Some already paid their bills, and some chose not to go to college at all. So while the conversation is for another day, and maybe even more appropriate, another podcast, I knew I wanted to provide for the future of my own program in higher education. At many schools of education, secondary and teacher education takes precedence in most of the resources, and that is understandable. The discipline of higher education is very important as a foundational curriculum for any discipline, and especially a doctorate in education is designed for someone who's going to run or be part of the administration. Many of my cohorts at William & Mary felt the same way about giving back, and one colleague came up with a genius way to do that. It's true that educators are not the highest paid occupations, and so since William & Mary was established in 1693, she set to give $16.93 a month. Then the next year, she would come up with a way to increase it based on those same numbers of the founding of the college of 1693. I thought it was brilliant, and I've shared that story with others. And I've hinted throughout the podcast that I started investing in the stock market in about 1983 or so, and it wasn't a lot because, again, I was in the military and didn't make a lot. But it is how I learned how to trade in the market, and I'm all self-taught. I decided after my time at William & Mary that my portfolio would be used for philanthropy, and that's how it's been since. My retirement is certainly satisfactory to live on. And so I started giving to the college, and eventually I endowed my first project, the Professor John Thielen Scholarship in Higher Education. I named it after my mentor and advisor at William & Mary, because of how much he gave to me and all of his students, and in fairness, I'm not entirely sure I would have finished had it not been for his support. From there, my projects grew, and eventually the dean of the school asked me to join the development board. Now, I wasn't sure I wanted to do that, and by this time, I was in Washington, D.C., and going back to meetings seemed like a lot. Eventually, she wore me down, and I agreed. It was valuable learning experience about how and where the endowments are used and the growth of the school's mission and influence well outside Williamsburg. So I did it for a year, and I said, oh, well, it was nice meeting you all, and I really had a great experience. Oh, wait, it's a 3-year term. No one told me that. So I eventually finished my term. I did a second term, and that was enough for me. And I was moved to being an emeritus board member. The School of Education was gifted the old Sentara Hospital in Williamsburg during my tenure on the board. And so I decided to endow the boardroom and eventually added a doctoral fellowship, and the names of the recipients are posted on plaques in the boardroom. When I was at UT, a student and his girlfriend went down to William & Mary because she thought she might like to attend there. And he came back and he said, "Did you know that there's a Terwilliger boardroom at William & Mary?" I said, "Yes, I endowed it." Each year, I get a profile of the fellows, and it's quite frankly exciting to see how their research can be enriched within the discipline and by the fellowships. Since then, I have continued to support and expanded well outside William & Mary, in part because the portfolio has grown and because I've seen more opportunity to make a lasting difference in student and faculty research. And of course, I realize I don't have children, and so there's only so much that Kona can do with the money. Back at the FDIC, the learning curve, no pun intended, was steep. And in learning about my own organization, the agency, and all of the interconnected aspects, it is a curious culture, and almost anyone who works there will echo that same sentiment. And the union atmosphere was very strong, certainly compared to what I had experienced in the past. Now, I did have limited experience with unions while in the military, because I did have civilian employees from time to time. I did have limited experience because I wasn't at the top of the food chain and didn't have that same kind of interaction. You may remember that even my first job at the cheese factory, it was also heavy on the role of a union. And that's when we had the breaks, and I leaned forward and moved the cheese into the warehouse before getting that amazing promotion of cheese poker. Since I was an officer of the corporation, I would help with the negotiations with the union on some level and for a new contract, as well as with employees who were members of the union during periods of discipline. And let me tell you, those negotiations were very interesting indeed. In hindsight, let me just say that it was more interesting to see how cases unfolded and in some ways how the union would defend employees with more vigor than you'd expect, especially when the facts were so prominent. The staff meetings with the chairman were also unique. The big focus, of course, was what was going on in the various business lines. And you quickly learn that when a colleague might occasionally dig themselves a hole in the meeting, when it came your turn as they went around the table, either something very bland was said or just pass. In addition to staff meetings, the board meetings, all of which were public due to the Sunshine Law and it is a federal corporation, were also a unique experience. The board, by law, has to have appointees who identified as Republican or Democrat, and yet a minority of the board was required to be of the opposing party. Members are statutory with three within the FDIC, the chairman, the vice chairman, and a director, and the comptroller of the currency, or OCC, and the director of the Office of Thrift Supervision, or OTS. Now, today, the CFPB took the place of OTS when it was dissolved in 2011 and merged into the OCC. During my tenure, the FDIC director was Tom Curry, whose political affiliation was independent. So that helped maintain the composition required by law when the administration would change. Anyway, the board had little interaction with the staff because the chairman was also considered the CEO of the agency. Now, I'm not the most astute, as you know by now, and Tom Curry lived less than a mile from my place. And one day I was out and someone said, "Tom, Tom, Tom." And finally, I guess they were talking to me, and I turned around, and he was maybe 3 feet from me by that point. And he said, "Tom Curry." And I just didn't recognize him outside the normal business attire and environment of the FDIC. And I might have even told this story as well. I was out in D.C. with my aunt, and we passed a gentleman. And I whispered to her after we were a few steps away and said, "You know, that guy looks just like Jesse Jackson." And she said, "It was." You know what? Everyone should wear a name tag, just for me. So now that you have the lay of the land from last week and into this week, there's one other important nuance that I had to quickly learn. Unlike the federal government that operates on a year from October 1st to September 30th, the FDIC operates on a calendar year. I arrived just ahead of the budget process, and as you would expect, it takes several months from start to finish. And I got one piece of advice early on to lay low during this process because I was new. It's quite unusual compared to my previous experiences because the directors are the ones who meet with the budget office and, we meet repeatedly. And after submitting our proposal, there is a bit of horse trading and more so a strong defense of the entire budget that your peers would have the responsibility to support before it went to the chairman and then the board of directors for approval. Now, it didn't go outside the FDIC for approval. And based on my experience, the board approval was generally pro forma as long as the inside board members were aligned. As I said earlier, my predecessor did a good job of the organizational structure of the corporation, and he had already submitted a first go of our budget for the new year. My deputy was largely in charge of the budget and the process with the other deputies and managers, so the advice to sing Kumbaya seemed appropriate. There was just one thing, though. Remember that I already had some personal experience of seeing the housing market start its decline during my condo flipping days. And you may remember during that period of time, the rampant buying of homes across the United States with all kinds of lending options that were, well, now we know, suspect, the news was becoming concerning. The division within the responsibility of handling failing banks was DRR, and the director was not only one of the most respected leaders of the FDIC, he was my strongest advocate of corporate university, especially our leadership program, and of course, the program supporting his division. And I'll talk more about the leadership program in another episode. The role of corporate university with DRR at the time was limited. Remember, I had a liaison who was not a learning professional in Dallas, where the operational offices of DRR are located. And we had about 12 years since the last crisis. And when that happens, the division gets leaner and leaner over time. It makes sense. The budget isn't going to pay for people who aren't actually resolving failing banks. But at the same time, the staff has to maintain recurring training to keep on the ready for when they are needed. Call it my military experience or my learning background, this recurring training was not non-existent. It just wasn't as robust as was needed. And I quickly figured that out. In short order of arriving, I started to lay out an idea with my senior executives how to create a learning center in Dallas with a small team to create the learning for the next crisis and, of course, needing a leader down there as well. Or do we continue to try to do it from Washington? In Washington, on my staff, there was one person that worked on the DRR learning programs. You can imagine where this is going. Oh, great. The new guy, an outsider, is going to be seen as expanding his kingdom. That is not going to go over well, and especially we're in the middle of the budget process. Now, my team did think it was a good idea for next year. The problem is next year was a long time away. Since the approval for our 2008 budget would be approved by mid-October or so, and the next cycle would be mid-October of 2008 for 2009, and that really meant being able to hire, create a viable office would be 2010. If I have one strength, it's my strategic ability. I talked to the DRR, Mitchell, and my boss, and Mitchell was for it. He realized and saw that his division needed a more robust learning program and said it will be tough to move forward. And my boss was even more skeptical. Since I was new, he did try to give me some support and at the same time, cautious. And I asked him one question. I was hired to figure out where the needs of the corporation were with learning, right? And this seemed like a huge business line void. Notably, he and Mitchell were not only very good friends, they were long-term employees together. So long story short, I make a proposal and my phone rings off the hook. What are you doing? We advise you to stand back this year. Oh well, the honeymoon period was already over. I finally was told I had to meet with the chairman because she was not in my camp with this new idea. So I'm in a room with my boss, several of my peers, and the budget director, and she pointedly suggested that this was the key thing that I was pushing for corporate university. And she said, quote, "Do you know what else is even going on in your organization?" End quote. I was taken back, to be sure. I wanted to say, of course I do, but Mitchell chimed in and gave his support, noting that this was something that was on their plate and they just didn't or weren't able to move it forward. It just wasn't where it needed to be. And he also wanted me to look at developing career ladders for the division's employees. They were also getting ready to start using the CEP program, or remember the program that Corporate University had for new hires for their division as well. We had a couple more meetings and I couldn't believe it. I got the approval. I also got some less than happy colleagues because it was important to prove that this was the right decision. In addition to hiring a professional staff, we also created an associate chief learning officer position with the thinking that that person we hire will have to speak on my behalf in Dallas at a pay grade that he or she wouldn't be pushed around. The team came on board very quickly, and as you'll soon see, the financial crisis that technically started in 2007, just after I arrived at the FDIC, went through the period of about 2009, and it was so significant that more than 400 banks failed during this crisis. And it was said by many after the crisis that without the Dallas Learning Center, the success would have been more difficult due to the contributions that Corporate University made. In hindsight, we also hired amazingly highly qualified professionals, and we moved quite quickly as history unfolded, forcing the team to move quickly as well. Like I said last week, sometimes a leader just gets lucky. I didn't know enough about the agency mission to have foreseen the importance of the Dallas Learning Center. I just saw the void in one business line area of the agency, and by chance, it was the go-to-war readiness part that resolves when there was a crisis in the country. I'll share a little more about that in another episode because I actually was able to go to some bank closures and it is an extremely interesting process. There were some really nice perks at the FDIC. The main building and the Virginia Square campus both had full cafeterias and it was subsidized by the agency as a benefit. So it was quite reasonable in price and a nice spectrum of food offerings. In addition, there was an executive dining room in the main building that was very nice. We would meet there with senior staff when you wanted to do a one-on-one business lunch with a colleague. We had our own medical and dental insurance in addition to what was offered by the federal system, and you could pick and choose what you needed. The advantage of the FDIC program was it was delineated where you could take different pieces and parts of what your medical needs were. So I only chose the FDIC's dental program since I had my military medical program or TRICARE, and that doesn't include dental. Oh, by the way, there is a veterans dental program that is, let's say, horrible. Anyway, we also had our own 401k in addition to the government 401k or TSP. When TSP was first made available to the military right before I retired, it was not on a matching basis. So my TSP was minimal when I started the DFDIC. This was a great chance to move that forward, and with the two options available and how the matching worked, and I don't remember all of those details, it was a very, very good thing. Anyway, they also had a free or maybe nearly free life insurance program for executives. And fast forward, when I retired from the FDIC, I was able to take my discounted dental insurance and my life insurance into retirement. We also had a change in technology that was very similar to what happened at NDU when we integrated PeopleSoft. The FDIC was moving through the program of integrating Saba for our Learning Pro platform, and so I was invited to serve eventually on the Saba customer board. From there, I was invited on other groups just because I kept learning and interacting with some of my peers outside the FDIC. These were really nice ways for me to both gain another view of corporate universities outside the government, as well as develop some very meaningful professional relationships. The most memorable CLOs that I met and worked with were the CLO of United Airlines, Qualcomm, the Four Seasons Hotels, and, now as you can imagine, the CLO of the Four Seasons and the Ritz-Carlton both have intensive learning programs because of their status in the hotel industry. From my own time overseeing the Air Force Lodging Program, I had great interest on how they did their team programs. One of their biggest, of course, is customer relations. Every employee at the Ritz-Carlton has great authority to resolve customer issues, and the CLO had a term that she often used called radar on, antenna up. Her employees were expected to have their radar on. This meant that employees should be aware of the guests and get ahead of issues by recognizing some of negative body language or just a comment that maybe we need to interject. Antenna up means to have an extra sense of the full scenario. And the example she gives was a situation with a guest and how they resolved it. The team member had a bottle of wine sent to the guest's room because there was a kerfuffle, I guess, at the counter. What the team member didn't recognize was that the guest was a delegate of AA, or Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was in the record. So remember, radar on, antenna up. And you can use that, or I've actually tried to use it, maybe not always well, in my own interactions with other people. I learned a lot as the CLO from my peers in and outside the FDIC and from my team. In addition, I was able to share with others that I've kept up with more traditional higher education that corporate universities have some of the same processes and issues, as well as some different ones that normal or typical schools might have. The CLO is the leader of the university, and some, like the FDIC, have students from outside the organization, as well as the primary responsibility for all learning inside. CLOs across the corporate world have a plethora of titles and scopes of responsibility. Some are positions like I was, and some are deep within the organization, usually with a different title and often embedded in either HR or a business line of the organization. And I will tell you that those CLOs all envied that we were not underneath, buried in the organization, because obviously you have a lot more freedom to navigate the needs. Next week, I'll continue my experience with the VA, the FDIC moving into the financial crisis, and what it was like in the post-crisis world. Thank you for listening and sharing the podcast. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful week.